Hello, I'm Eric Meyer. I'm a developer advocate at Egalia.
And I am Brian Cardell. I'm also a developer advocate at Egalia.
And this week we're talking about polyfills. So poly, I'm just going to do a very brief historical note. Polyfill, for those who aren't aware, is, I guess, a UK term for sort of like spackle or something that you use to fill in cracks or gaps and then it hardens. And so that's why that term ended up being used to refer to like little bits of JavaScript that we write to make up for the fact that one of the browsers we have to support doesn't yet support a CSS thing or a JavaScript thing or even an HTML thing. Yeah, so
there's like, I think this is an interesting thing that happens a lot of times in like, not necessarily in standards, but in, you know, like libraries and, you know, language basically around computers, is that like a thing is developing, an idea is developing, there's some like commonality developing to it, but that doesn't have a name or it goes by a whole bunch of names. And then we give it a name and we rally around that name. And then like the fact that we're all talking about the same thing also then like helps us move forward in other ways, because we can like understand what we're talking about and think about it more concretely, you know. So right. You know, like Remy Sharp introduced that word but didn't invent polyfills, right? Like
right,
he just gave them a really good name and an analogy that makes a lot of sense in the UK and not much in any other place. but it's okay because the word kind of works, in my opinion. I guess people have different sense of whether that's okay or not, whether it needs the metaphor, but yeah, I like it. I think this also has happened with, like, for example, I don't know if you know the sort of famous Gang of Four design patterns book, but most of the patterns in there are like, it's not like those people invented those patterns necessarily. It's like that they identified and named them, and they said like,
yeah,
this is a singleton, and we've been doing singletons already at that point for, you know, a couple of decades maybe, but we didn't have a name for it, and we didn't have a common, this is the pattern. So
yeah, or the invention of the term Ajax to,
yeah, exactly, yeah,
you know, HTTP request stuff, or for that matter responsive web design.
Exactly, yeah,
the concept that was emerging. I would argue that Ethan did a little more work to sort of tie the pieces together. But it's not that he necessarily invented out of thin air the whole concept of responsive web design, but he did give it a very handy name and show in a very compelling way how this should work. So
amazing demo that really sold you. Yeah.
Yep. So, right. So that's how we get the name polyfill. So if you didn't know that, great. Now you do.
Like very quickly we got to like ideas like modernizer and you know, basically developers made it possible to move forward because the IE was stuck, right? And they had most of the market share. So there was this like real tension between like, hey, there's this potentially really interesting cool stuff, but practically speaking, we can't, like, there's no real excuse for you to actually use it, you know. So it's very chicken and egg problem, and polyfills like made it feasible for you to consider exploring some of that stuff.
Yeah, Dean Edwards IE7 was a in many ways groundbreaking in this area, where he wrote a bunch of effectively CSS support for IE6 at a time when there was never going to be another Internet Explorer. Like you said, Internet Explorer was just stuck. It wasn't moving, and IE6 was supposedly the last ever version of Internet Explorer, and people wanted to, you know, use stuff that IE6 didn't support. So Dean called it IE7, sort of as a I don't know, a little bit of an elbow. And then a few years later, Microsoft said, "Oh yeah, just kidding. We're going to do more Internet Explorers."
Yeah,
but yeah, it was. I can't remember. It's been too long now. I can't remember what IE7 added support for.
Oh, it was almost nothing. Yeah, it was very, very small additions. It was just barely moving us forward. They were important mainly in that they restarted things. I mean, it was not wasn't a significant catch up. I can't remember what the specific ads were either, but they were really small.
I mean, some of them, but it was, in a lot of ways, it helped people move forward with CSS. I mean, it was really what it was mostly focused on. But
yeah.
Anyway, yeah. So, there's this long history of hacking our way around problems.
Right.
Which is, that's computer engineering since the dawn of time, pretty much. But yeah, we have...
Well, there was a lot of things happening at that same time, which is interesting. Like another thing that seems to happen in history is like a lot of like early ideas and things are like crashing together. And, so there were a bunch of people who started building a lot of polyfills for the early stuff because there was a lot to catch up on. I think I wrote a piece one time where I just literally went through and iterated all of the APIs and put them into a giant like green and red table, and the trouble is that like the gaps then, because it stayed stagnant, like the gaps kept growing and growing and growing. And I wrote this piece one time that showed that there were like 1500 in maybe 2012 or 2013, something like that. It's like 1500 APIs that were little squares that were red now in Microsoft land. And it just kept growing and growing and growing, So there were people like actively patching those because you don't need in practice all 1500 of those, right? Like if you don't use those 1500, who cares? Right.
Right. Yeah.
So practically speaking, you could find which of those you needed and find the polyfills as long as they existed. And so there are a few people who wrote like just gobs and gobs of polyfills. John Neal was one of those people. Do you know John?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Matthias Bynes. A lot of those got used in, you could use those with like Modernizer, and a bunch of them were even embedded into the MDN documentation.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that, but that used to be a thing where like with array methods, for example.
Okay. Yeah.
There were implementations of the array methods in the MDN where, it was like, here's how you check for support and here's how you still enable support if it's not available, because that was like such a common, like I said, it was like 90 some percent of your users didn't have support for it.
Right.
So yeah, there's a lot of thinking going on around polyfills and also around like modules. Cause like, don't forget, this is like, this is before ES 2015.
Yeah. So so polyfills are super, super useful.
Right? Yeah. They're super useful.
Really useful. And, sometimes that leads us down paths that in retrospect, maybe weren't the best. Like we've had a situation recently where polyfill.io, which is a centralized library service, there's been trouble, right? Basically, from what I understand, the maintainer sold it, and now whoever they sold it to started serving weirdness in the... up to people who were linking to that. It's sort of like if Google Fonts, right, that most everybody just links straight to the Google Fonts servers and loads the fonts from there. If they started serving, corrupted fonts or something like that, or fonts that had executable code embedded in them, which I recently saw is actually a thing you can do, so that has happened. And there are now articles from Cloudflare about how to automatically replace links to polyfill.io with, something less troublesome. And just a whole lot of people saying, wow, everything gets ruined. But, you know, there's a part of me that's like, why did you link to a service in the first place? Why did you not have a local copy?
Yeah, but this happens all the time, right? So,
sure.
So this originates in all the way back in 2014. In 2014, there was an article on hacks.mozilla.org. And it was co-authored by Robert Nyman, who we've done a lot of work with,
yeah.
And Andrew Betts. I don't know if you know Andrew. Do you know him?
I do not think I do.
So Andrew was very involved in the community. He also was an event organizer. He organized like all of the EdgeConf and stuff like that. That's not about the Edge browser.
Not about the browser, right?
Yeah. And yeah, I think maybe also had a UK meetup, but a UK web standards meetup. But then also he served on the W3C technical architecture group.
Maybe I do slightly recognize him. I don't think we've ever met though. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's a very smart guy, but anyway, the article introduced this idea of a service, and what the service would do is look at the browser. You know,
right.
It had a few ways that it could work. So I don't want to be unfair to it, but it had a few ways that it could work. But the easiest way, the one that kind of won the day, was that it would look at your browser and try to identify your browser. And then it would say, well, I know what things are missing. Right.
Right.
And it would provide the polyfills for those, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, this was great and terrible at the same time, like in my opinion. I think I was always honest about, like, I'm not sure that really relying on that is good in the long run. But that wasn't a thought on anybody's mind in 2014, really. You know, I mean, it just got popular and people used it. And it was then he also was the founder of FT Labs, the Financial Times,
yep,
like arm of the technical arm. And so like it was very scalable. It didn't involve a very lot of setup. You didn't have to deal with maintenance if there were issues. Right. I mean, it's complicated. Like, one of the comments that I made early on was like, well, you're using user agent sniffing. Is that really, that doesn't seem like the best thing. And they addressed that in the article, why they chose it. Cause like maybe this particular version of IE has a broken implementation of that. So you can't just feature detect it, you know? So I don't know. It was very, very interesting. It featured almost all of the polyfills by the two gentlemen that we mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And there's again a lot of other things going on at the same time. About the same time, we were also had established this extensible web community group and been talking about this idea that I was out evangelizing. That like, hey, here's an interesting idea. If you can polyfill two browsers of three or four, why can't you polyfill four browsers of four, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't we experiment like that? And like, why is it that, and I actually was representing at about this point, jQuery in the CSS working group. Like, why is it that everybody is like, jQuery has won, why don't we just standardize jQuery? Why is it that we can't do that? And it's like, well, because we didn't plan to do that, so now we can't do it, right? Because which version of jQuery are you going to standardize? And if you choose the wrong one, then, well, there is no right one, because you will break some websites no matter which one you standardize, you know? And there are ideas in jQuery that fit jQuery fine, but actually didn't match the CSS philosophy of things. So like jQuery, if you said like selector for an ID selector, it would always give you the first one. It would just map that to get element by ID. But, you know, in there's nothing special about an ID in CSS. It's, you know, in terms of like, it doesn't actually limit them. So if you have 10 things with that ID and you say they should all be blue, they'll all be blue.
Yeah.
And then it takes really long because we can't agree. We can't like have ideas that actually compete somehow. If you do it in a standard and we can't be wrong. Like we, like, you know, there's so much fear that we just can't be wrong. And so it was like, what if the web was like extensible so that you could evolve the web, you know, you could find out what worked and what didn't work. We could run sort of multiple experiments and quickly, because you don't need to write C and stuff, you know, like,
yeah.
So we also registered this website called prolifill.io, which was a play on words, you know, term that we coined that was like, what if we can't call it a polyfill, because polyfill is the, in the metaphor, it's like filling these small holes, right? But this is like standing up new walls, you know? So we needed like, this isn't a polyfill. We don't want people to get confused. This isn't definitely a standard. This is like a proposal for a standard, you know? And along the way, we also helped set up Robin Bergeon, who we had on recently, was at W3C at the time. And he and I set up a Discord instance that we called Specifiction.
Yeah.
And, you know, we basically, this became the incubator community group, you know, the idea that you would want to like incubate ideas and say like, these ones are not, they're not on a standards track yet, but like, we would like to figure them out among a group of people that is really serious about it, that, and maybe make some polyfills and run some tests. And then along the way, in addition to polyfills, we got origin trials, which is an interesting thing we could talk about maybe, but.
Yeah, I mean, in this vision, to me, polyfills do for the sort of the web in general what preprocessors have done in CSS land, which is there's a lot of, in the preprocessors, you can do things like, you know, variables and mix-ins and come up with functions that do color shifting or whatever. And then the ones that become popular because they're useful eventually make their way into CSS. Like we have variables, they're not called that, but we kind of have variables, and we have mix-ins are coming very pretty soon. That's being worked on now. So, the color shifting stuff is there and supported in at least some browsers. I think maybe all of the engines now. I'd have to check on that. But, right, like that's sort of what preprocessors have done in the CSS space, is allow the community, like the wider community, to experiment with ideas, and for someone to come up with an idea and say, hey, here's this thing. If anyone would like to use it, here's how you use it. And then if a bunch of people use it, then eventually the relevant working group, in this case, the CSS working group, says, yeah, that should be a thing that we actually have natively. And so these polyfills or prolifills in either case can be that way for CSS, but also for JavaScript, for HTML, right? Where you can write a polyfill that, I don't know, adds support for a completely new image format or a new vector image format. Right. And it might be a huge polyfill, but if it turns out to be really useful, then people maybe start using it a lot. And then that serves as a signal to the standardization world that, hey, maybe this should actually be standardized and made native. And that, I really like that. I wrote a piece, it's been a lot of years ago now, called JavaScript Will Save Us All, which was a little bit of maybe hubris, but it was sort of making this argument. It's like, hey, if browsers lag, we can write JavaScript to get them up to date, as we've been doing, and we can also speculatively, you know, like try things and see if we can figure things out, new things that even if the various working groups shrivel up and die, we still have the ability to extend the web. I never did anything with it. The accessible web people actually, I'm not in any way claiming that my article inspired that, but actually did work towards that. So they, you know, they actually get the credit. I get the credit for having an idea and publishing a blog post, which is about as low effort as you can get in this space.
But I think it fits in with that whole naming thing, because like I said, it's like, you know, somebody articulated it, but I don't know that there weren't a ton of people having very similar thoughts, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because like right around the same time was the birth of really transpilers. Another way that you can try to evolve the web. You can do experiments in transpilers.
Mm, yeah.
They can help shape, as you said, like CSS, but also JavaScript. And later, actually, while he was on the technical architecture group, Tag has findings that are not, they're not standards, you know, but they are agreed upon by the members of Tag. And this was a piece that was called Polyfills and the Evolution of the Web. It was published 10 days before my birthday in 2017.
Yeah, okay.
It talks about how polyfills can be a way for us to help shape the web. And one of the things that they did in this that I just want to mention is that they explain that whole difference about polyfill. And while it is a useful metaphor to some people, it's has problems. And it also recognizes that we have this polyfill idea, and that there were very similar ideas that were slightly different that were called like ponyfills and nautifill and like all these things. And they suggested that those are difficult to pronounce in some languages. They're, you know, there were probably was very of the time kind of word. So, you know, they're not, it's not the best word, you know. So polyfill, like it or not, was, we were stuck with that. And so they suggested that speculative polyfill is a better name. And I agree, actually. It's it's less fun than polyfill, but unfortunately, it was made after there was a book published by O'Reilly that I actually wrote a blurb for. I didn't write the book. Building Polyfills, that's what it was called. It was by Brandon Satrom. It was published in 2014. It talks about polyfills. So, whoops. But this idea of like also having one URL that you could use, it also offered where you could, in theory, you know, in theory, you're caching these on CDN, right? So they're on the CDN,
right?
Like there's a finite number of variants, and they can on the CDN, they can just hash those, quickly identify your browser, and like just look up the right hash and send that back to you, you know. So this is like a cache at the edge where you can have n possible answers but get the right one very quickly from something that is hopefully geographically close, but
right.
But there are also not no issues with that, right? I mean, there was there were other reasons at the time that we wanted to point to a CDN. And it's funny that like the lay of the land changes, right? Because most of those things, most of the other reasons that we used to want to do that, they're not true anymore. Because like we used to think like, well, if you could point everybody at, say, the jQuery CDN to get jQuery, then it's not as good as native, but you can cache just one copy for everybody, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, well, caches don't work like that anymore. And there was, like, so much work around that as an idea. But it's not, they don't work like that anymore. Like, websites each all get their own fully independent copy of cache, so there's no sharing. But maybe we can talk about that whole hash idea, because that is relevant to a thing that developed at around the same time.
Go for it.
Called sub-resource integrity.
Yeah.
And sub-resource integrity had among its original use cases these similar ideas that was like, we could maybe just cache once for everybody, you know, like, so you could only have one copy of jQuery. And so, they were trying to combat this idea that there's a danger in that, because what if everybody trusts this server and then something happens where somebody compromised this server,
right?
Or like, doesn't it have to be, well, I mean, I guess that's still compromising it, right? I mean, there's many, many ways that it could be compromised, right?
Yeah. One of them is it could transfer ownership and the new owners do something
nefarious.
New. Yeah, different with it. It's nefarious or otherwise, but yeah, it could be nefarious.
That's right. It doesn't even have to be nefarious. It just means changing the contract, and you're not getting back what you think you agreed to.
Right.
Yeah.
So sub-resource integrity, tell me if I'm getting this wrong, because I might be, but from what I gather, it's a way of essentially signing things that you're going to be loading. So to go back to that jQuery CDN example, you know, where we said, okay, let's set up a CDN that's just for jQuery, and everybody can point to that, you know, and a more recent version of this would be Google Fonts, right? Where we, you know, lots of people just point at the Google Fonts site, the CDN. But sub-resource integrity was a way to essentially sign that thing that everyone's pointing to. And then everyone that's pointing to it also has a copy of that signature. And then if it ever changes, then the signature changes and something happens, a warning or a error or something like that. Am I roughly correct?
Yeah, I mean, almost. So it's a hash. So it's just like a crypto algorithm. It's a cryptographic algorithm that you run across it that generates some hash that you would use in to uniquely identify this thing. And so there's some well-known hash algorithms in the browser. And you can say, I want this to be my JavaScript, or I believe you can do it with CSS as well. But only if it ultimately matches this hash. So you go get all the content, you run this cryptographic algorithm across it, and if the number that, you know, not the number, the hash, mismatch of strings and numbers that you wind up with at the end is the same, then you use it. Otherwise, you just, you know, throw an exception in the console. I mean, it doesn't interrupt your program. Otherwise, it just doesn't happen. It's as if it failed, you know?
Right. The browser acts as if it couldn't load the thing.
Exactly.
Because it refuses to load the thing because its hash doesn't match the hash that the browser expects.
It does tell you why.
Sure.
Yeah.
But from a sort of from the user end point of view, in a way, it's as if the thing didn't load. So, you know, if Google Fonts were using this and the font changed in this, the hash changed, like that custom font being loaded from Google wouldn't load. The page would render, but the font wouldn't load until the site was updated or whatever process there was of saying, yeah, I trust that thing.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
So yeah, at the time, because we were talking about like the caching thing, there was a really compelling use case to say like, well, man, I can make it really fast because I could be like, okay, well, we want jQuery 1.3, right? So that seemed like a really great idea to me. And I remember being really excited about this. And I put this on the tags radar for a tag review because I thought, wow, that's like, that would be so great. But then somebody pointed out the problem with that I hadn't realized, which is that let's say you go to XYZ porn site and you find some obscure thing that only exists on that website, you know, like their logo maybe, or, you know, like whatever.
Okay.
And then we include that on my website. we include that on my website. And if you visit my website, by looking at the time it takes to load, I can have a pretty good sense of whether you've been to XYZ porn site.
Right? Okay. I'm reminded of, yes, the CSS visiting problem. But it's, so, this is a timing attack as opposed to a loading attack, but it's still, it's a fingerprinter. It's an identifier. It's a way to say you have been to X place or you have whatever.
Anyway, lots of issues with like that caused us to eventually be like, nope, no shared caches at all, which is like a little bit of a shame, to be honest with you. Around the same time, we were trying other ways to do that. And I remember that Adi Osmani, also from jQuery standards team, had made this thing. Mm-hmm. Not just him and some other people had made this thing called basket.js. And what it tried to do is like use local storage for caching and loading and like allowed you to build and manage the cache. And like it turned out that it was actually kind of slower anyway. Maybe one of those things where, you know, you're trying to squeeze every last drop out of it and you're basing that on the current state of things, but then the state of things changes and now it's not fast enough anymore. Yeah, we also then made a version of that called tap.js. There's a few of us that worked on that. It was like me and Yoav worked a little bit on it and someone named Leo Strauss. A few other people too were kind of involved in this, but it was sort of a similar thing, but it was like trying to do like cross domain through an iframe. And I believe if I'm not wrong, it supported modules out of the box. So like, but those are like common JS modules. They're like the kind that pre-existed regular modules today. But yeah, I mean, there was all these ideas about like modules and like caching and like CDNs and polyfills and like all this stuff was crashing together. And like the state of the world has changed a little bit, not a little bit, a lot since then. And one of the things that changed, was the owner of the domain polyfill.io. So turns out that Andrew never actually owned that. I'm not sure who did own that. But somebody had bought the domain, and it led to this this big issue. And I mean that is an issue with domains. Domains are the one part of the web that are centralized, right? We have centralized domain names.
Yeah.
Yep. And I think we know this, right? Like we've seen that happen before. Well,
I mean it's distributed, but it's a point of weakness, point of failure, point of something where, if you accidentally let your domain expire, somebody else can grab it and do stuff, nefarious or otherwise. Yeah. And so in this case, I think we touched on it before, but, you know, just to sort of recap for those who aren't familiar, there was polyfill.io, and then apparently it got moved into a different CDN. However that happened. And so now you've got, like I said, Cloudflare and Akamai and all these, you know, sort of global CDN networks publishing articles about how polyfill.io is now being used in a supply chain attack is what it's called. Apparently the new owner of polyfill.io has angrily denied that they're participating in a supply chain attack, but you know, everyone from the outside certainly seems to think that something's going on, and it sure looks like a supply chain attack. So, you know, things are being served up that are not, you know, the original polyfills. Maybe stuff has been added onto them to the polyfill scripts, or they've just been outright replaced with different scripts. And the Register has an article that says something like, if you're using polyfill.io as over 100,000 people are, you need to change your links immediately. And that is, you know, I could imagine something similar happening if NPM were ever compromised in this way or a similar way. Or
I mean, CDN.js, yeah. Like there's so many things that are like this that yeah. people just use. And, yeah. you know, mm-hmm. another reason that people use them, well, let's go back to the SRI thing for a minute. So mm-hmm. like the thing that clashes here that we get a sort of like budding of two ideas that are sort of like incompatible in a way that create a problem is that like if you have a website and you even believe all those answers that were like, well, you look at the UA string because there are different versions and I don't want to maintain this, I want to rely on you to maintain it, that means that like you accept whatever they send back to you at any point in yeah. time, you know.
Yeah, and you kind of have to.
That's like you used to be able to on jQuery CDN or any CDN that served jQuery used to be able to say, give me the latest jQuery, I just want the latest one.
Mm, whatever that is,
like yeah. well, that's great until it breaks, right? Right. And so the question yeah. is like in production, what do you do? Because you know, we have this tension today too, even with like browsers and things, like you need to get security patches, you know, you need to get updates. You don't mm-hmm. want to mm-hmm. be reliant on those kind of things to have like for you to be aware of them. Cause it was difficult to even be aware that they were happening for your whole supply chain. Right. So, you know, you would point at this CDN and say, I trust you to update. That is totally in conflict with SRI because it means you can't know, you know, you can't know what the mm-hmm. what the thing is. And I think for a lot of people, like just trust somebody else to do it was really appealing, you know, and so that's what they did. And so they couldn't use even SRI, even if they wanted to. And then some other people have asked the question like, well, if you have a hash for that thing, it means that basically the only thing that you will accept is exactly that code, right? And it's a static yep. file. So why not just put it on your website or your website's CDN rather than rely mm-hmm. on some other thing, you know?
Yep.
So, yeah, I don't know. That's all tricky and smashing together. And maybe the really interesting pivot here, too, is that because we're talking about hashes and the world is changing and all these things, like along the way, a thing that's happened since then is people have talked about using hashes for a lot of other things. So IPFS mm-hmm. uses hashes to identify content. And that and other distributed web things do similar. And they have this idea that's like more like peer-to-peer networking sort of where, I mean, I'm not an expert in this area, but like if you remember things like, you know, Napster and, you know, well, I don't know, I guess I'm aging myself by naming those kind of technologies, but you know, where you could have like a swarm of people who all had the same file. And you can even be downloading parts of it from different people, you know, to sort of optimize so that you're not taking too much of any one of those servers and so on, you know. So that's a pretty interesting idea because you could just say, like, I want jQuery 1.6. And it doesn't matter where it came from, right? Doesn't matter because I'm not mm-hmm. saying I want jQuery 1.6. I'm saying I want this hash, and whoever has this hash, just give it to me. I can get it from anywhere or simultaneously from parts of it from six different places if I wanted to, you know. So that's a really interesting idea.
Yeah, it is. As long as you're confident that, you know, there's no hash collision or at least incredibly minimal Excellent. Hash collision.
Do you want to talk
risk.
About that?
Yeah, a hash collision is where if you basically can you have two different things yield the same hash, right? So if jQuery 1.6 yields, you know, this hash? Can you also have realbadthings.js yield exactly that same hash? Because if you can, then someone can put up realbadthings.js. And then if you have a system that's just looking for hashes, be like, just give me this hash. I just need this hash wherever. Okay, I'll take that one. And it turns out not to be jQuery 1.6. It does bad things. It's crypto miner, right, or whatever. People who create hashing algorithms, generally speaking, if they're trying to do a good job, will work very hard to, construct a system that is incredibly unlikely to have hash collisions. I think mathematically you can't absolutely rule them out. Odds of one in many illions. I don't even know how many illions that it would be, septaquadrillions or something. Chance of two unrelated things yielding the same hash. So yeah, there's this desire for trust and reliability, and there's a desire for flexibility, and those two things conflict. Like, as far as I can tell, it's an unresolvable thing. You want the flexibility to just be able to say, just give me the latest version of jQuery from wherever. I don't care where it comes from. I just want the latest version of jQuery from the web or the net. And being able to do that is fundamentally in conflict with the desire to want to be absolutely certain that you're getting a version of jQuery 1.6 or the version of jQuery 1.6. Like, those two things just don't go together. And I'm sure it's not the only place we see that tension. Like, we always want our jobs to be easier, but in at least some cases, the things that, the way to make the job easier also makes it more fragile in some ways. Like, makes the processes less robust and less trustworthy. Yeah. Right. So we saw that with polyfill.io. And I actually said earlier, what if, like, maybe NPM could be supply chain attacked. And then that twigged in my head, wait, weren't they? And I went and looked, and a couple of years ago, there was a supply chain attack on like a few dozen NPM packages where it started, with the updates, when people just ran their NPM update, whatever, they got the latest version of whatever these packages were. There were, as I say, a couple dozen, few dozen of them, something like that, that had malicious code in them.
Yeah. Or
certainly had code that was in no way related to what the package was originally intended to do and what it was installed for. And there were news articles and, trying to get the word out as much as possible, like, check your packages, check to make sure if you're using one of these packages that you didn't get the malicious code, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because NPM gives you a lot of flexibility and offloads a lot of the burden of maintaining this stuff to somebody else. Like, it becomes somebody else's problem. I don't have to deal with this. I just grab the code and thank them very much for providing the code in my head. But my company probably doesn't actually donate any money to support the people who maintain those packages. And then, they get compromised. Maybe somebody who's running, who's been writing some packages is like, nobody ever donates. Nobody ever supports my Patreon. I've been doing this for free, and now I've got somebody who's willing to pay me $25,000 for my five packages. I'm going to take it.
Yeah, or just what I've seen happen in other cases. There have been a lot of cases like this over the years, but that's one where it gets bought out. Another is just like it was a domain, and whoever owned the domain retired or died or
lost interest,
forgot that like it was on this credit card that was no longer valid and it just expired and they lost the domain, or in terms of like the NPM packages, what happens is Joe Schmo has this idea for a library that maybe is useful, and he makes this library that is maybe useful, and suddenly people notice it and it is useful. It takes a lot of it gets a community around it, and this community then becomes like big corporations, you know, like Google, Facebook, Apple, you know, everybody is using at some point through the supply chain this person's labors for free, and nobody is sponsoring it, and it's not their day job, and he's like lots of pull requests to deal with, and it just gets exhausting. And you know, after doing it for years, you get somebody in the community who is helping out a lot, you know, and they offer to take it off your hands and continue the work. But, you know, you don't know them. You only know them from their commits. And then it turns out that they were just playing the long game to get, you know, to get access to the thing that's already in everybody's code. Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. And there's, again, this tension because from a code standpoint, the hash thing is, I mean, that's what we've always done in a way, right? Like if you remember, like you would download stuff, it would always say like, get this MD5 checksum and run it and make sure that the thing that you got is this thing, you know? I mean, that's the whole idea here. And for code, that makes a lot of sense technically to make sure that it doesn't break. But also, like you said, practically speaking, who is going through and chasing all of those through the system and reviewing them and making sure that evil didn't creep in at like the thing that does left pad on strings, you know?
Yeah. Yep. That old left pad.
I mean, there's so many things like that. I don't know. Yeah. It's really tricky. I don't really have a total answer to it either. Part of it, I would say, is coming to grips with, not to sound like a broken record or a constant commercial for the same ideas, but like I think coming to grips with the realities of open source. Like I think we're far enough into the open source era that we can see that the current shape of it is imperfect, you know?
Yes.
We need open source to be actively funded. We need it to not be so one way. We need to think about how we deal with issues of trust and safety. And, you know, I think yep. we have some learning to do on this, another interesting corollary here though, is like, you know, when you're just asking for content. So, you know, if you want an image, if you can ask for it via hash, in theory that would eliminate the you know, the domain problem, you know, where like somebody right. can steal the domain, or not steal it, but just your lease is over, it's somebody else's now, you know, you gave it away, you know, so now somebody else controls it and it's no longer that thing. This is a really big deal for verifiability too, right? So if you want the web to last a long time and you want to be able to make sure that this link that I am sending to you, that like it will be the thing that I'm looking at right now, you know, I want to save this and make sure that I don't point this for reasons of like avoiding misinformation and stuff, you know? So there is also in schema.org, Dan Brickley has similar proposals that like maybe this is good for that too. Maybe we should look at hashes as a way to say for content that I'm linking to, even, you know, that is this what I think it is? And this also gets tricky, not to... I've built systems that use like hashes incredibly. And when you start using them for like a web page, boy, that's super tricky because it means that anything that you like, what are you hashing exactly? Right. So like if I hash just the content of the HTML, you'll verify that I get the HTML, but somebody can have JavaScript or CSS that modifies the page. So it doesn't mean that I've got the page, right? Or if I say, mm-hmm. I want to make sure that this page is exactly what I say it is. Well, yeah. What happens if they change the copyright date at the bottom?
Yep.
You know, like it's very, very tricky for all these purposes, but I do just think it's like so interesting that we want to build things that are somehow maintainable and safe and performant. And we have mm-hmm. like efforts in all these areas, but over time, sort of the facts on the ground change too. And it gets, I don't know, they cross pollinate each other, but they also kind of like make the story difficult for the other ones in a way.
Yep.
Yeah.
As we always say, it's difficult and it depends.
Yeah.
Like what's the solution here? Well, it depends. What do you want to optimize for, basically?
So yeah, if you're using polyfill.io, you shouldn't be using polyfill.io anymore.
Turns out. Hopefully there will be more clarity over time as to what actually mm-hmm. happened, but, and who knows, maybe it will all get resolved and cleaned up. But even if it does, I think the question at the other end of that is, do you go back to using it? I mean, I would argue no, but
yeah, I don't know. I don't know that the point of this chat is to suggest solutions as much as,
yeah. Just sort of explore
and talk about the history and the things that were happening and how we got to that problem.
Yeah. Cool. Brian, thanks.
Thanks. Good chat.
Good chat, indeed.